The two missed tests, then. Chilly grimaced sympathetically. You could come along after. You'd still see a couple of the movies.
I don't know, I said.
Come, she urged. If not for the movies, then because the Valhalla has the world's best stale biscuits and soapy tea at interval.
I grinned. Do I have to pay for the whole marathon?
A very White Star question.
No, but it'll be my shout anyway, Chilly said.
I might have refused, but I realized with a burst of pleasure that this was how it was with friends. I was thinking about Jilly as I approached the glass doors at the front entrance to the school, when I saw Harlan Sanderson standing by the school gates, talking to a couple of guys in expensive, casual clothes. He was as handsome and perfectly groomed as ever, and his black hair shone darkly in the sunlight. He glanced towards the entrance, and although he could not possibly have seen me through the reflector glass, I felt suddenly certain that he was looking for me. A wave of inexplicable fear flowed through me. Without thought, I turned and went back down the hall to a door which brought me out on the far side of the school. Once outside, I cut across the oval, knowing the school buildings would hide my retreat from Harlan. I went through a gate in the oval fence that led me into a lane, which, a few minutes later, brought me to Stapleton Park. It was only after I had passed into the shadows of the big trees growing there that I slowed down and thought with incredulity about what had just happened. The weird, powerful fear I had experienced must be my subconscious reacting to the memory of that awful smell he had given off. But why was I reacting to it now? Why not when I'd seen him in class earlier this week? Even thinking about what had happened at the school made me feel uneasy, so I forced my thoughts away from Harlan and focused my attention determinedly on the carpet of red and yellow leaves that lay under the trees. I let my senses take me into their delicious fermenting smell, and before long I was kicking through them as enthusiastically as a little kid. By the time I reached the end of the trees, I was breathless but also relaxed. I walked up to the top of a small hill where people were flying kites and let my mind go to the kites. For a while, it was as if I was there, at the end of those fragile strings, bouncing and jerking and longing to go with the wind that tugged at me. I did not allow myself to think again about what had happened at the school until I was in my room. Then I wrote. It was like a documentary we saw at school about a gazelle who scents a hyena and flees. But what possible danger could Harlan Sanderson represent to me? It wasn't as if he knew about my altered senses, and even if he did, what harm could he cause? In a movie, Harlan might want to sell his information to some shady government group of scientists who hunted down people with abilities that could be used as weapons and performed hideous experiments on them. But in real life, he's a handsome, dark-haired guy with buckets of charm and a smile to die for. I thought some more. Then I wrote, maybe it was actually the guys with Harlan that set off my danger sense. One of them was a skinhead, which always makes me think of concentration camps and neo-Nazis. They had both emanated a dangerous toughness, even though they were wearing expensive-looking clothes. I guess I will know for sure when I see Harlan again. I put the journal away and went downstairs for dinner. When I saw Serenity was stirring the pot, I sighed inwardly. These days the food she made was either totally tasteless or spiced with such impossible combinations that it was too peculiar to eat. She glanced up from stirring as I came in, and I caught the strong scent of licorice. Sybil, my mind whispered insistently, and my skin rose into goose flesh. On impulse, I asked, why did you change your name?
I told you why, she said coldly.
Yeah, but that was ages back, I said, and realized that I was holding my hands up, as if she was threatening to shoot me. She looked a bit as if she wanted to.
Too bad, she snapped.
I bit back the words that jumped to my lips and waited. Finally, Serenity shot me an irritated look. That name Mum and Dad gave me then, that's their name. It's their way of claiming me. But I belong to myself, and I want to name myself. They were good lines, but they didn't sound like Serenity. And the bit about Mum and Dad wanting to own her would have sounded a lot more convincing if they were possessive or controlling parents. Quite probably,
She was quoting one of her beloved poets, but I knew better than to suggest it.
But why Sybil?
A hesitation. The name doesn't matter, she answered finally, turning back to the pot. I thought she'd finished, but she said in a low, forceful voice, Principles matter, things you believe in, and they only matter if you act on them.
Dar and Miranda came clattering in the door, and she closed her mouth like a trapdoor. Smells good, Sybil, Dar said warmly.
Serenity glared at him and flung out of the room, muttering that we could help ourselves.
I like that, Miranda said, hands on her hips. Serving's part of it, Dar, isn't that right?
13. On Friday, we had one period of English, and a notice on the timetable said Mrs. Barker was taking it as usual. I told myself it was good, because it meant I would get near enough to smell Harlan. Of course, I was nervous that seeing him would set off my gazelle instinct, so when I stepped into the classroom, I clamped hard on all my senses to make sure I didn't do anything crazy in case he still smelled bad. Clamping was a technique I had discovered which allowed me to bring the extended portion of my senses back to normal levels, but I was so rattled that I clamped too hard. The class hubbub immediately faded, and colour bled out of everything and everyone. It was like I was stepping into a black-and-white movie. At the same time, the whispering in the air that I had been noticing since the accident got much louder. A black-and-white Mrs. Barker looked up and spoke to me, pointing to the seat next to Jilly. I couldn't hear what she was saying because of how loud the whispering was, but the gesture was unmistakable. I headed for the seat. Harlan was directly behind Jilly. To my relief, I felt no desire to flee, even though Harlan was looking at me along with everyone else in the class. He smiled, and I felt a little shock of warmth at how beautiful his smile was. I sat down. Mrs. Barker was still looking at me and talking, but now she had an annoyed expression. I hastily released the clamp, and it was beyond strange to see her skin and clothes and the room behind her suffuse with sudden colour.
"I'd better get a new alarm clock, Alison," she was saying sharply. "One that will wake you early enough to ensure you're not still asleep when you arrive late at school."
She swung back to the board without waiting for me to respond. I opened my folder and sat staring at it until I sensed the other kids had lost interest in me. Only then did I dart a glance at Jilly, who looked worried. I smiled at her sheepishly, and she visibly relaxed. It was hard to concentrate on essays and books after that, because I kept envisaging Harlan smiling at me. I felt confused, because part of me was swooning over the warmth in his smile, but another bit of me was remembering how the sight of him the day before had filled me with fear, and of course I didn't understand why. I was almost relieved when, after the bell went, I heard Harlan call my name. I summoned up the thickest part of my screen as I turned and clamped down on my extended senses just in case they ordered me to do anything stupid. Dimly, I registered Jilly's admiring look as she went out. Harlan was weaving through the chairs towards me, his smile delicious. But when he got closer, my heart began to pound because the sick, horrible stench was still pouring off him. It was as if he had been carrying something dead in his pocket that had become even more rotten and decomposed.
"Aye,"
Harlan said, coming to lean on my desk. It took an immense effort of will to respond in a normal voice, because even screening and clamping, I could still smell his awful stench. In my agitation, I began to clamp too hard again, turning Harlan to black and white and his voice to a thread. I had to strain to hear above the whispering in the air about us. Despite my efforts to keep smiling, the strain must have begun to show, because puzzlement flickered in Harlan's eyes. "Careful," ordered a soft, stern voice inside me. I searched for something innocuous to say and blurted out that I had given the flash drive to Serenity. Harlan's smile widened.
"That wasn't why I wanted to talk to you, Alison," he said, his mouth caressing my name. "I was thinking we could partner for this excursion."
"Excursion?" Harlan laughed and his hair moved over his scalp, soft and dark, as a million spiderweb thin strands of black silk.
We've got an impressionist writing excursion to Skavern Amusement Park. Did you hear Mrs. Barker announce it in class? She'll tell us the date after the play is over.
I could not think of a sensible reason to refuse to partner him. I could hardly say, I can't partner you because you smell like you're dying inside. Careful, 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 the voice inside me urged.
So I'll see you later,
Harlan said, and he sketched a wave and walked out of the room. I leaned weakly against my desk, sick and shaking. The irony was that I loved impressionist writing. It was this thing Mrs. Barker invented, where you went somewhere and sat with a partner watching the world go by, writing down anything that came into your mind. It wasn't stream-of-consciousness writing, which is more about what you're thinking. It was about recording life without imposing yourself on what you saw. A month ago, I would have been in heaven to have Harlan want to partner me. Now, all I knew was that I had to get out of it, even if it meant faking sick and staying home on the day. Fortunately, I had a spare period next, because I could not have coped with a class just then. I went to the library, thinking that Harlan could not smell the way he did, because he was sick, unless he had some sickness which had yet to make an impact on his health. That made me think about cancer. But could Dr. Austin also have cancer? It was too far-fetched, and cancer wasn't catching. Or, if it was, then medical science hadn't figured it out yet. After I had bidden Jilly goodbye at the end of the day, I found myself thinking about Harlan again, about the perversity of his becoming interested in me now when I could not bear to be near him. I reached the Vietnamese greengrocer's, where I had got into the habit of buying an apple or a plum to eat on the way home, but it was late, and the neat little man who owned the shop was dismantling the displays of fruit and piling them into baskets. I stopped to watch him work. He was so old that his limbs and face were like lovingly waxed wood. But though his movements appeared slow, they were so precise that he was actually working very swiftly, one movement flowing seamlessly into the next. It was like a dance, and when I let my screen fade, it didn't surprise me that he smelled deliciously of lemon tree leaves. Mr. Rackett had read to us about the Japanese samurai, who believed that all tasks, however small, ought to be performed as perfectly and completely as possible. They would have approved of this old man, I thought. Without warning, he turned to look at me, and I saw from his expression that he had been aware of my gaze all along. I was not screening, and I ought to have felt the pressure of his attention, but I felt only a continuation of the peace that watching him had brought me. In a way, it was like looking into Luke's face. He tilted his head sideways and squinted, as if looking at me in bright light. Then he said something. Of course I didn't understand, but he went on for quite a while, his voice gentle but insistent, the lemon leaf smell of him intensifying until my mouth began to water. Then he stopped, a question in his expression. I shrugged and smiled. He nodded as if I had spoken and took one of the persimmons from his basket, offering it to me with a low bow. Not knowing what else to do, I took it and bowed back. The man smiled, and apple blossom infused the tang of citrus leaf. Then he went inside his shop. I lifted the persimmon to my nose and sniffed at its cool skin. Its fragrance made my mouth water as I bit into it, and I let myself take the flavor in with all of my extended sense of taste. The juice spurted into my mouth, and a blissful laughter bubbled out of me. At the same moment, a bird poured a wonderful cascade of notes into the afternoon air. I caught sight of myself in a shop window, greedily eating the juicy persimmon and grinning like a village idiot, and it occurred to me that the changes in my senses had given me access to unusual joy as well as to mystery and darkness. When I got home, Wombat was lying on the threshold of the kitchen door like a fat welcome mat. I stopped to stroke him, and his purr sputtered loudly to life like a little engine. He gave out a nice leather smell, which told me that he'd been waiting for me to come home and stroke him. It was interesting how strongly his sense connected to meaning. I told him in words how glad I was to see him too, wondering suddenly if I was giving off a scent meaning that echoed my words. He gave off a freshly laundered shirt smell, which was a request to be scratched under the chin. I obeyed and sensed his awareness of my contentment as a sweet smell that reminded me of Dar's caramelized sugar smell. Is that how my contentment smells? I wondered. I was really startled to smell the cheesy fragrance Wombat used to tell me yes. My pulse sped up at the thought that the cat had actually understood my question far more clearly than he would have understood the words I said aloud. Was it possible that I could make my scent messages as specific as his? Can you smell this? I thought at him hard. The cheesy smell, then a burst of burnt toast. Too loud, I guessed. The cheese smell again. Wombat was now sitting up and staring at me expectantly. He twitched his long tail and began to give off a series of smells. I forced myself not to think about what they might mean, but just to take in the smells. Gradually, the meaning was clear. Wombat was telling me that before, my smell communications had been weak and unfocused like those of other humans. Then after I had come back from being away, they had suddenly become painfully loud. And just now, they were as precise as any animal's, though still too loud. I thought at him gently and very calmly. Pat me with your paw, if this is better. He immediately pressed his soft paw lightly against my knee, purring and giving off a strong, fishy smell of approval. I grew hot with excitement and felt like cheering. Maybe some bit of me did cheer because Wombat hissed and spat and sprang away. He would not be coaxed back, but sat by the fence twitching his tail in disapproval. Sorry, I called, and went inside, hardly able to wait to try to communicate with other animals. For the first time, I regretted our family's dislike of owning animals. Wombat didn't count, because he had just turned up on our doorstep as a full-grown cat and refused to leave. He chose us, Dar always said. I wanted to record what had just happened in my journal, but Miranda was in the kitchen, and she said dramatically, "You are not going to believe this. Jessie is writing." That got my attention. "Writing," she nodded. "Dar says he's been at it on and off all this week, but today he didn't even come down for a snack. You know what a snacker he is." "You don't seem all that surprised," she complained. I didn't have to respond because the phone rang and she pounced on it. I went up to my room feeling excited at the thought of Jessie finally pouring his intense, bursting thoughts onto a page, and also smug, because it had been my suggestion. I heard the clack-clack of Mum's old typewriter as I passed Jessie's room and realized that it must have been him using it when I'd heard it before. 14. Serenity was in our bedroom, sitting on the rug on my side of the room with Luke, who was plucking the strings of her cello. There was a delicate scent of violet in the air, and on impulse I asked, "Why don't you play any more?" "Music doesn't seem relevant," she said, sounding tired and flat. I sat on my bed. "Relevant to what?" To my life now," Serenity said. "Relevant to the life you would have as Sybil?" I asked. She flinched and grew rigid, the violet smell metamorphosing into licorice. "What do you mean?" "I don't know," I said. "It just seems to me like you're trying to make yourself into something, but you don't know what it means to be that thing, and when you do, it'll be too late." She stood up with Luke in her arms. "I don't have the faintest idea what you're talking about." Her voice was haughty, and aniseed began to infuse her smell. This was what I smelled whenever she was pretending to eat or sleep, and I thought of it as the scent of deception. But what was she lying about? Luke was laughing at me from her embrace, opening his mouth in a shape of joy that contrasted so sharply with the tight, closed look on Serenity's gaunt face that fear jabbed at me. Maybe my expression was too revealing, because abruptly she thrust Luke into my arms and left the room. Luke gazed at me, and I let my screen fall and was instantly entranced by his face and smell. That first night home, after I had got out of hospital, I had noticed the wonderful smell, but I had soon realized that the smell of the house was actually something to do with how we all knitted together as a family around Luke. It was so delicious and compelling that it left no room for my concern about Serenity. Luke was like a flower, opening its face widely to the sun and the rain and the wind, utterly open, utterly absorbed, endlessly absorbing. I was still playing with him when Da poked his head in and said he'd take him so I could do my homework. I said I didn't have any, then remembered the tests I was supposed to do the next day. I had studied already, but I wanted to read my notes through one last time. I told Da, and he offered to pick me up after the tests, but I said I would make my own way home after the movies with Chili. He laughed when I mentioned the Valhalla Theater, saying he'd gone there himself when he was a student. Then he dropped to his hands and knees and began to snuffle at Luke, like a bear trying to reach up a tree to get a baby. Luke gave a squeal of joy and stuck his belly out, and we both laughed. "He knows he's seeing a star in the making," I said slyly.
"I don't know about a star," Da said, "but the manager of the green room rang today and asked if we'd like to play regularly for a while."
"How regularly?" I asked, and his smile became wry.
"You're a hard case, Alley Cat. Once a fortnight, in fact, but it's better than nothing, and it's straight pay rather than a cut of the door, and we can sell discs. Plus, it will save us from the phone bill that just arrived."
For a moment, ammonia tinged the coffee ground smell.
"I just wish we had the money to do a proper recording and get the discs pressed rather than just burning them ourselves. But that won't happen without the backing of a company. We could do downloads, but we've said we wouldn't go that route."
I was startled, because Da usually said that it was better to do your own discs rather than have them made and produced by recording companies who only wanted to turn music into a product. As for downloads, the band decided against selling them off a website, because without a company and its legal department to back you up, you had no protection against being pirated. Mind you, anyone could get a CD and put music up on the internet. But even as I opened my mouth to say that, Luke gave a sloppy blurt, and we both laughed.
"Do you know Jesse's writing?" Da asked, after we rolled around with Luke for a while.
I nodded. Da shook his head.
"It's funny that you told him to write, and then he goes ahead and does it, as if it was the answer he'd never figured out. He won't talk about what he's writing, though."
"I think it's better not to talk about things that you're going to write, because then you start thinking about how other people will feel about them, and that changes how you think," I said.
Da looked impressed. "That's pretty profound stuff."
"It's just how I feel when I have to write something for Mrs. Barker," I said diffidently. "I just want to do it. I don't want to talk about doing it."
"Maybe right," Da said thoughtfully. "What I love about improvised music is that you don't talk about it at all. It just evolves, and it's purely musical evolution. It's like jamming, but on a more serious and exploratory level."
He nodded.
"Okay, I'll take your advice and leave Jesse to talk to the white page. I think you did a seriously good thing suggesting it. I've never seen him like this."
Luke started to grizzle, and I scooped him up out of my arms.
"Let's go wake Mama, Luke the Fluke."
He glanced back.
"Oh, I forgot. I came up to tell you that everyone is making their own dinner tonight. Jesse is other-directed at the moment."
Luke chilled with excitement as they went out. Saturday morning, I got up late and fooled around bathing Luke before I had to get ready and head off for school. I was trying to feel like a martyr for having to go in on the weekend, but it was such a beautiful, crisp day, and it really felt good to be out in it. I felt pretty well prepared for anything the tests could throw at me, and it was kind of nice to have something important to do on a weekend instead of just killing time. Plus, I was looking forward to the movies afterwards. I went through the park, trying pointlessly to send scent messages to birds and squirrels. Then I came round the outside of the schoolyard and ended up arriving at the front gate just as Mrs. Barker pulled up in the staff car park. I summoned up the screen as I came over to her car.
"You're early," she said, smiling as she got out. "The government assessor won't be here for another half an hour."
"It's nice to be out," I said, relieved that she was not annoyed at me for being inattentive in class the previous day.
"It's certainly a beautiful day."
She rummaged for her keys as we passed through the gate and unlocked the front door. I followed her down the corridor to the staff room and hovered outside.
"Come on in, Elizon," she called. "It's not an official school day, so I think we can dispense with the usual formalities. Do you drink coffee?"
"Sure,"
I said. I'd only drunk it a couple of times, but it seemed to go with sitting in the staff room. We even have a milk frother, Mrs. Barker said, bustling about and making coffee with the same cheerful competence she always showed in the classroom. Instead of her usual knit suit, she was wearing expensive-looking jeans tucked into long black boots and a loose cotton jumper that slid off one shoulder and matched her scarlet lipstick. Her hair was out, too, instead of being tied back, and it made her look younger and more glamorous. "What are you thinking?" she asked. "You look different," I said. "Younger, more..." "More? I don't know, just more," I said. She laughed, and I could smell something like wisteria as she shook her head. "You were always an original, Alison." I saw the warmth in her eyes and realized that the wisteria smell was connected to her liking for me, because she had also given it off in the hallway when she told me about the tests. "Now what are you thinking?" Mrs. Barker asked. "You ask a lot of questions," I countered. She smiled. "I do. I guess I became a teacher because I like asking questions." "Questions?" I said. "I thought teachers were about having all the answers." "Only bad teachers," Mrs. Barker said easily. "Good teachers are about asking questions and provoking them in students." She hesitated, and then she said, "Alison, I hope it won't upset you if I say this, but you've been very different since your accident." My heart lurched into a jerky trot. "Your work in class has always been solid and occasionally very bright," she continued. "But now there's something new in the things you turn in, a quality that, well, I'm not the only teacher to wonder at it. I can even tell you that initially some of my colleagues thought maybe your parents were doing your work for you." "Your colleagues?" She understood what I meant. "Not me. The thoughts, though startling, still felt like the Alison I know. And also, I know that you and your father are not the sort of people to operate that way. But the suggestion didn't hold water anyway, because the same quality was apparent in work completed during sessions in class." I don't know how I looked, but Mrs. Barker frowned at whatever she saw in my face. "I didn't mean to embarrass you." I see things differently," I began. And I stopped, because part of me was tempted to tell her the truth. "That's it exactly," Mrs. Barker said, seeming not to notice that I'd cut myself off. "It's as if you're seeing things from some deeper perspective. I don't mind telling you that I've seldom had so much pleasure in reading a student's work." The assessor arrived then, to my relief, and maybe to Mrs. Barker's as well, because she jumped up at once and introduced us. Then she made him coffee too. He told her to call him Hunter as we carried our drinks into the small conference room. I wondered if that was his first or last name. Hunter explained that I had an hour and a half for each paper and that I must stop immediately when he told me. There was to be a half-hour break between the two sessions for lunch, and Mrs. Barker asked if I'd brought sandwiches. When I said I hadn't, she said she'd buy something for me while I was doing the first test. "Eating might make me sleepy," I said, because I had no spare money other than what I needed for the movies. I finished the first test in an hour and a quarter and used the extra time to read through and correct my spelling mistakes. Mostly it was text-based questions and comparisons. I'd read all the possible texts, so I was free to choose the ones I liked most. I had said as much as I could, as well as I could, using as many examples as I could recall. I didn't feel I would do anything differently if I had to sit the test again. It's always a bad sign if, on the way out of the exam, you think of all the things you should have put in. I hungrily ate the focaccia Mrs. Barker had bought me, and she waved away my offer to pay her back next week, which was a relief. I took a walk then just to get some fresh air, then I went back in and sat the second test. It was harder, being partly creative, but I liked the toughness of the clear-thinking exercises, and I was disappointed to run out of time before I'd properly wound up my third essay. "Never mind," Mrs. Barker said as the assessor shuffled the papers together and slipped them in an envelope. He sealed it, and then he and Mrs. Barker signed and dated it. It was after 5 when we came outside. Night was starting to close in, but the light was really beautiful, all pink and gold and purple. I felt tired but contented. "How do you think you did?" Mrs. Barker asked after the assessor had driven off. We were standing by the car, and she pressed her keys to unlock the doors. "I think," I began, and then stopped, because she was looking past me, with a strange expression on her face. At the same time, her lovely bread smell was overlaid with the unpleasant smell of spoiled milk.
I started to turn to see what had caught her attention, but she grabbed me by the arm and almost pushed me towards her car. Luckily, I was wearing a jumper, so she didn't touch my skin.
"Get in, Alison. I'll drive you home."
Her tone was so urgent that I obeyed, and a moment later we were pulling away from the curb.
"Please don't look back," she said quickly,
just as I was about to do that. It wasn't until she turned into the next street that the sour milk smell faded.
"Mrs. Barker?" I ventured.
She bit her lip and gave me a sideways glance that was, of all things, slightly embarrassed. She turned her eyes back to the road and hitched a quick breath.
Helen Sanderson was on the other side of the road.
I felt as if she'd thrown cold water in my face, but she was staring at the road, so she didn't see my reaction.
"Did you arrange to meet after the tests?" she went on.
"No," I said, trying to make myself look calm despite the pounding of my heart. Again, that quick, searching, sideways stare. Maybe I wasn't controlling my expression as well as I thought, because she said, with obvious surprise, "You don't like him." I opened my mouth to say that I did like him, but realized it was no longer true. The old Alison, who had hero-worshipped Harlan from afar for months, who had longed for him to notice her, had been supplanted by the new Alison, who could smell something terrible in him, and who wanted only to have him go back to not knowing she existed.
I don't like him being interested in me, I finally said.
I see. A long pause.
Do you think he was waiting for you just now?
I swallowed. Maybe someone told him about the tests.
Don't you like him?
I don't think that is an appropriate question for me to answer, Mrs. Barker said stiffly, but she must have realized how silly that sounded after she had just asked me the same question, because then she said awkwardly,
I noticed Harlan speaking to you after class the other day.
He wants me to partner him for the excursion to Skaven Park, I said, to see how she would react.
Did you refuse?
The sour milk smell was suddenly very strong. I shook my head. She nodded approvingly.
It's best if you don't humiliate Harlan. I can easily introduce something other than simple partnering for the Skaven Park excursion, or I might even put it off altogether, given that the weather is unreliable.
Her face was now composed and teacherly.
As for missing him just now, you'll be able to say quite honestly that you didn't see him.
She was trying hard to make our conversation seem normal, but it wasn't. I desperately wanted to ask why the sight of him had made her drive us away in such a panic, because it reminded me all too vividly of my own flight from the school the night I had seen Harlan outside with the two tough guys. But she had resumed her teacher persona, and I sensed that any attempt to dig would only make her more tight-lipped. When we reached the outskirts of town, I asked her to let me out at the bus stop.
I'll drive you home, she said firmly.
Did she think I meant to sneak back and meet up with Harlan? I told her, I have to meet Jilly for the movies. Mrs. Barker pulled the car up by the bus stop, and I got out. I didn't know what to say, so I just thanked her and said I would see her in school. After she had driven away, it was ages before a bus arrived. I thought over everything that had happened, feeling more and more uneasy and confused about Harlan. Mrs. Barker's negative reaction to him had been too strong to dismiss as her subconscious reaction to Harlan's smell, which meant she must know something about him, and whatever it was made her dislike him and want to keep me away from him. Maybe he'd done something wrong, and Mrs. Barker had heard about it. But it would have to have happened before he shifted schools, because there was not the slightest rumor about him. Certainly not among the kids, and teachers seemed to like him as universally as students. That meant whatever Mrs. Barker knew must have happened outside of school. Something else struck me. Rumor said Harlan had gone to a private school before, but wealthy parents did not switch their beloved son from a private school to a public one without some compelling reason. Was it possible that whatever he had done was so bad that he had been expelled, and no other private school would accept him? Although, if only Mrs. Barker knew, it might be something she'd learned privately. A relative or friend might have told her something. She wouldn't break a confidence, and she wouldn't gossip, no matter how horrible the thing she had heard. But she might keep an eye on Harlan, and warn someone off him if he seemed to take an interest. The bus came trundling along, and I was glad to be distracted from the uneasy mystery of Harlan Sanderson. I paid the fare and sat down, hoping the bus driver would remember his promise to let me know when we arrived at the street nearest the Valhalla Theatre. Bus drivers always got mad at you if they forgot to tell you where you were supposed to get off.
15.
I thought you'd changed your mind, Jilly said, as I came up to her outside the Valhalla, sipping muddy-looking tea from a styrofoam cup. It took longer than I expected, I said. You've missed the attack of the killer tomatoes, Jilly said severely. Oh, heck and damn, I said. She laughed. Come on, let me introduce you to my friends. My heart sank, and I strengthened my screen. The friends turned out to be a handsome old guy of about 24 in a wheelchair whose name was Raoul, a super-thin, haunted-looking girl called Sari, with short, spiky hair and clothes too ragged to be anything but a fashion statement, and a grey-eyed guy with glasses and floppy, longish blonde hair called Harrison.
After Harrison Ford, can you believe it?
He asked glumly. He had a Scottish accent, but I liked the way it made his words sound.
Parents of the pits, why couldn't they call me Leopold after Leopold Bloom or Pushkin or something with literary dignity?
Pushkin isn't a name with dignity. It's a cat's name, Sari objected.
Cats have a lot more dignity than some humans, Harrison said.
Sari stuck out a pierced tongue, then grinned at me. We'd call him Harry, but then we'd be Harry and Sari like some sort of horrible comedy team. I laughed, liking them all enough to move to a thinner section of my protective screen. Sari gave off the mingled odours of peppermint and popcorn, with a strong, slightly unsettling undercent of camphor. Her body language told me she was a lot more nervous and wound up than she pretended to be, and I guessed that the camphor expressed that. Harrison was almost exactly my height and a year younger than me, with a clever, gloomy Woody Allen wit that made him seem older. It was his smell that struck me most, because it was the lovely scent of cedar wood and also pine needles and lavender, all smells I really loved. And of course the pine needle scent reminded me of Da. Raoul was harder because he was so madly in love with Jilly that his sense of really good olive oil and lemon and some sort of polish were all mixed up with her sea smell. I only had to look into Jilly's face to see she felt the same, but oddly, they didn't show their attraction to one another. I wondered why Jilly didn't just let Raoul know she liked him. I couldn't believe it was because of the wheelchair, but it was none of my business. So I filed the question and drank some tea, which really did taste of soap. I told you, Jilly said, watching me. I grimaced. I thought you were exaggerating for effect. We went in to watch Creature from the Black Lagoon, and I nearly laughed myself sick at the man in his black wetsuit with badly glued-on rubber protrusions running around as the creature. The gentle, silly innocence of that old movie was the perfect antidote to the strange and alarming things that had crept into my life lately, especially when they were accompanied by Harrison's hilarious whispered asides, which seemed all the funnier because of his accent. My cheeks and stomach hurt from laughing long before the movie was over, and Jilly kept whispering to me not to encourage him. She was sitting at the end of the row beside Raoul, who was in his wheelchair in the aisle. Sari was on the other side of Harrison, her eyes glued to the screen like a kid. She actually screamed a couple of times, which cracked up the audience, though she was too mesmerized to notice. The final movie was The Blob, which I'd seen before at a friend's house. The interval was so brief that we stayed in our seats. I listened to the others spar as we sat waiting, hearing in their ease with one another the length and strength of their friendship. It was impossible to guess where Jilly had met them all, because they each seemed so different, and I was certain none of them were from our school. There was something vaguely familiar about Harrison, though, but I couldn't think where I might have seen him. Everything my new senses told me about them made me like them more rather than less, and I found myself wishing I had such a group of friends. It occurred to me only when Harrison elbowed me hard for not listening to him that they were warming to me as easily as I was to them. At the end of the night, we all came outside groaning and stretching and complaining about our eyes. Never again, Jilly groaned. 5 movies is too many.
You say that every time, Raoul teased her.
How about a pizza? Sari asked. I have some free vouchers.
The last bus I can get home leaves in 10 minutes, I said regretfully.
Me too,
Harrison said. It turned out that we used the same bus line, but Harrison lived closer to the city than the school, so normally our journeys would not overlap. Harrison said that he sometimes came to visit someone out my way, which explained why he seemed familiar. I must have seen him on the bus. Raoul, Sari, and Jilly waited at the stop with us.
To protect you from sundry creatures of the night, Sari said, and they waved us off with mimed histrionics before heading off the other way.
There was only one couple on the bus besides us, locked in a tight clinch. Harrison rolled his eyes at them and headed for the back seat.
That was so great, I said, sitting beside him and feeling suddenly shy.
Harrison began talking about the movies we had seen in amazing detail, revealing an almost encyclopedic knowledge of movie making, and pretty soon I stopped feeling awkward. I always liked listening to people who were passionate about something. It turned out that he had an old Super 8 film camera and was planning to be a director when he grew up. I asked why he didn't have a digital camera, but he shook his head dismissively. He told me he was going to apply to the School of Film and Television as soon as he was old enough. He was actually in his final year at some special school, 2 years ahead of me. When he asked about me, I told him about Da's love of movies, thinking how they would like one another. I was telling him about the wildly successful gig with Urban Dingo when the bus came to his stop. I turned to wave as it pulled away. Harrison was standing under the streetlight, and his pale hair glowed white in the night, but I couldn't see his expression because his face was shadowed. As I got off the bus, I thought over the evening, relishing it. I hadn't had so much fun in a long time, and never with people outside my own family. The bus pulled away, dragged after its glaring headlights, and it became very dark because the bulb in the bus shelter light was smashed. Pulling my coat straight under the straps of my backpack, I looked up at the sky. There was what Da called a fingernail moon showing, and there was one bright star beside it, or maybe it was a planet. I heard a movement in the shadows of the bus shelter, and my pulse began to race.
"Who's there?"
I said, looking into the darkness. I willed myself to see better, but before my vision could extend fully, I smelled burning hair. My danger sense screamed at me to run, and I obeyed, taking off like a rabbit towards home. When I reached the gate and looked back along the street, there was no one in sight.
"Idiot," I scolded, thinking I'd probably smelled a rat's contemplation of the night's hunt.
I pressed my hand to my chest to feel the hammering of my heart. Just the same, I was glad to find Da and Titch in the kitchen, listening to a recording of their latest jam session. I put the kettle on and sat down and let their music wash the fear out of me. When the water boiled, I filled the coffee and teapots for the others and set out milk and sugar, mugs and spoons. Then I made myself a milky hot chocolate. But I had barely drunk half of it before I was yawning my head off. I went upstairs. It was late, but the light under Jesse's door and the muffled clack of the old typewriter keys meant he was still working. He must have put something under the typewriter to mute the sound. I went to my own room, undressed, and fell into bed. Sunday morning, I woke to Luke screaming. I sat bolt upright, heart pounding like a voodoo drum. Serenity was sitting up too, an expression of fright and alarm on her pale face. We were both in the process of scrambling out of bed when Da yelled that everything was okay.
"Luke just bumped his head," he shouted.
"Jesus," Serenity said, sinking back. "I nearly had a heart attack." I relaxed too, struck by how like her old self Serenity seemed. She even smelled strongly of violets. As she rolled over, hauling the blankets up around her neck, I realized all of my vague, dark thoughts about her transformation were silly and melodramatic. People didn't turn themselves into something else, except in movies like The Fly. I got up and went to shower, telling myself that Serenity was probably just going through some sort of stage. That was what teenagers were supposed to do, weren't they? 16. In the afternoon, I carried Luke into the garden under the jacaranda tree. It was a nice warm day, and I had laid a blanket down so he wouldn't graze himself on the path. I lay on my stomach and watched him gurgling happily to a blazing clump of nasturtiums. He grabbed one and ate it,
and I thought how instinctively and often babies used their sense of taste to explore the world. In a way, they were like little animals to begin with. Then they slowly moved from non-speaking to speaking, from acting instinctively to thinking, and acting only after they analyzed things. I wanted to relate this thought to my idea that the accident had awakened dormant abilities. My brain felt sluggish from the late night. Luke started wriggling towards a patch of prickles, and I caught him by the foot to stop him. He didn't seem to mind. Maybe he didn't connect the stopping with me hanging onto his foot. He started chewing industriously on the fringe of the blanket, and I closed my eyes, keeping hold of his warm little foot. Somewhere in the distance, I heard a mower start up. I slept for a while, and when I woke, I was still holding on to Luke's foot, and he was sound asleep. It was late enough that shadows striped the garden. The neighbor's dog was howling, which reminded me of Dad talking about writing and singing songs for the same reason as wolves howled at the moon. What he said had sounded lovely, but when you thought about it, the moon doesn't want anything from anyone. It's just this big cold lump of dirt that humans romanticize because of it being so far away and yet so visible. Before anyone had ever walked on the moon, people imagined all sorts of things about it. They had even imagined someone walking on it, and then Neil Armstrong had done it. He thought that thinking of walking on the moon was even more amazing than walking on the moon, because once you had imagined a thing, you only had to find a way to do it. I heard the floor creak and glanced through the screen door to see Jesse coming into the kitchen. He was moving furtively, and I heard him open and close the fridge door, then hurry away. I guessed that he was creeping around because he didn't want to talk about what he was writing. Talking would upset the delicate balance of the mind shapes he was building. I lay back and closed my eyes again with a feeling of contentment that would have made me purr if I was a cat. That night, I went to the school play because of Jilly being in the orchestra. It was the second night, and Dar came too, saying parents ought to support the school their kids attended. Miranda decided at the last minute to go as well, because Ricky was busy. The play turned out to be lame in parts, especially when Romeo kept forgetting his lines. There were a couple of kids who were really good, and Juliet was fantastic. She was big and plain, but she had this great voice, and when she said the lines, you felt as if she really meant them. I surreptitiously wiped away some tears when she said her last lines and died. The lead girl was very talented, Dar said afterwards. I wouldn't be surprised if we see her on the stage in a few years. Talent's only part of it, Miranda said, with that authority she always seems to give herself. You have to have guts and luck, too. Dar gave her a wry look and said mildly, talent may be only part of it, so is the heart only a little bit of your body, but without it the rest doesn't work. I love that about Dar, the way he could gently demolish an argument without getting mad or mean. But Miranda shrugged. Whatever. Juliet's name is Anne Humber, and she's planning to be a nurse. Well, maybe she'll have a talent for nursing, too, Dar murmured. Miranda, who has the attention span of a newt, was already channel surfing to find a station playing a song she liked. Once in bed, I lay thinking about Romeo and Juliet and how sad their story was. Not because they die, but because no matter how many times you see the story or read it, they always die. The directors could change this or that angle or dress the lovers in anything or nothing, but they could never change the dying because it was the whole point of the play. The inevitability of their deaths was what seemed sad to me. The idea that you could be trapped in a web of events whose outcome could not be changed. But maybe to Romeo and Juliet, it wouldn't feel as if they were trapped because they would only live their lives once. The bus ride to school the next morning was dominated by apprehension, because English was first period. I had managed not to think about Harlan much the day before, but now all the strangeness of how Mrs. Barker had reacted to his appearance at the school washed over me again. "You okay?" Jilly asked, after the homeroom teacher had gone out. I didn't answer because Harlan had entered the room. His eyes sought me out immediately, and my heart sank as he started towards me. I braced myself for his awful smell, but before he got close enough, Mrs. Barker arrived and told him briskly to sit down. He made a graceful bow to her that had the other girls in class sighing and giggling. Mrs. Barker smiled too, but but knowing how she really felt about Harlan made me see that it was a perfunctory smile that did not reach her eyes. She told him again to sit down, and then she began handing out papers. She had got round half the room before she told us that there had been some problem in gaining permissions for the excursion to Skaven Park, so it would have to be postponed. I didn't look at her when she put a paper down on my desk, because I felt strangely embarrassed by our secret complicity. The paper was a list of questions about a book we'd been reading, and when it had been completely distributed, Mrs. Barker went to the front of the class and said, "Understanding a question is part of what is required of you in tests and exams. It's not just a cattle prod to make you spill what you know on the page. Understanding a question requires you listen well. You'll find that a good bit of the answer is coded into the question." Explaining this took up most of the second period. Then we read through the questions and drafted some notes on how we might answer them and the approaches we might take. When the bell went, I packed up quickly, but before I could leave the room, I heard Mrs. Barker call out to Harlan. I didn't dare look back, but my neck crawled as I escaped. Maths was next, and I forgot everything in the lovely intricacy of fractals and prime numbers. I was still being careful not to show how I felt or answer questions too enthusiastically, but I noticed the teacher looking at me in puzzlement from time to time. At lunchtime, Jilly said she would skip the eating bit of lunch because she needed to do some research for an art theory assignment. I went with her to the library to start looking for information for a history assignment about codes of ethics, like the Hippocratic Oath and the Declaration of Independence. My idea was to research the samurai and see if they had a code, but I was disappointed and surprised to find the library had only one book showing elaborate Japanese battle attire. In the end, Jilly didn't get much of her assignment done either, because I spent half the time whispering corny lines from the horror movies we'd seen on the weekend to her and stifling laughter. Eventually, the librarian told me to quieten down or leave. Jilly whispered that she would stick with me even if I was a bad influence, because everyone knew it was when you split up that the monster got you. That night after school, I decided to try the city library to see if they had anything about samurai. I knew I could get a lift home with Serenity when Dar came to pick her up, because she always went on Mondays. There were the usual collection of types waiting to board the city-bound bus. School kids, but not too many. Yawning men and women in suits. A couple of guys in jeans and T-shirts with hip-hop logos. An older man wearing a grey cardigan. A very big woman who took up almost two whole seats when she sat down, and two boys with shorn heads playing some sort of rough kicking game as they waited. The bus pulled up, and we all got on. The big woman boarded first and sat behind the bus driver, making a joke with him about how fat she was. I marvelled that she could find her size funny, but when I got on, I brushed her bare forearm and got a flashing vision of her sitting alone in a bare little kitchen, eating a huge plate of food, tears streaming down her cheeks. At the same time, I felt the deep, grinding misery of her sadness, which seemed to follow me to the back of the bus as the smell of stale drains. Two men in front of my seat started talking about an article in the newspaper about a man who jumped off a bridge strut to land in the middle of peak hour traffic.
"That's 7 this year so far, and that's only the ones that get reported. My brother's in bridge maintenance, and he said they have about one jumper a week," one of them said. "All from the bridge, like they wanted everyone to know about them dying."
"Makes you wonder," the other said, and they fell silent. "Makes you wonder what?" I wondered. There weren't any books about samurai in the city library, and I was frustrated enough to ask one of the librarians, who said I should try searching under Bushido, because that was the correct name for the warrior code in feudal Japan.
"Samurai were just one rank among them, and not even the highest," he explained.
I typed Bushido into the search engine, and sure enough, there were 11 books listed. Two were online, but the rest were in the library. Probably there were a whole bunch in the school library as well. Preferring hard copies to e-books, I wrote down the reference numbers and went to get 4 of the most interesting-sounding titles. There was no sign of Serenity yet. It would just be my luck that this was the night she would break her cast-iron routine. I sat down and turned my attention to the books. It seemed that the librarian had been right about samurai being just one rank in the warrior class. In feudal Japan, the book explained, warriors were collectively known as bushi, and were men of valour and dignity, governed by a special code called Bushido. Men, I thought in feminist disgust. Maybe women don't have codes because they don't need them. Then I laughed at myself for getting mad at history. I read on. There was a lot about Japanese classes and various wars in which the Bushi had figured, which I skimmed. Then I came to a bit specifically about Bushido.
Also called the warrior's way, it said. Bushido was a system of codes and traditions which concerned justice, courage, benevolence, politeness, truthfulness, honour, loyalty, and self-control.
Justice, or rightness, the book went on, was supposed to be the most important rule of Bushido, which counselled its adherents to loathe crooked and underhand dealings. Every decision had to be based on what was right or wrong, and you had to be able to do what was right without wavering, even if it meant you would be injured or die doing it. No amount of physical strength or training or learning could make you a true Bushi if you didn't care about what was right. Warriors were also supposed to have courage, but I was surprised to read that courage was only valued if you were doing something that was right. I stopped to think about that one, because everyone felt they were in the right when it came to arguments. I could think of a million cases where one person's right was another person's wrong. For instance, a person being robbed might feel they were right to wound or even kill the robber. But what if the robber was starving and the victim was rich? You could even argue that in such a case, neither of them was wrong, and that the blame belonged to the society that let one person be rich while another was hungry. Maybe it was a matter of degrees of wrongness, too, because the robber would know they were wrong, but might feel it would be a greater wrong to let their family starve, and the rich person might think it was terrible to have so much when other people were starving. Of course, in the case of Japanese warriors, they were part of a rigidly hierarchical society, and were sworn to obey the shogun they were bound to, so individual conscience didn't count as much as loyalty to one's master. But how would a warrior of honour feel if his master decided he wanted to murder the shogun next door and steal his wife? Was it enough to be honourable in serving your shogun with courage, even if that shogun was dishonourable? Or, if his intentions were bad and you died helping him courageously, would it be said that you had died a dog's death? The death of a person in pursuit of dishonourable goals? My head was starting to ache a bit, so I stretched and looked around. There was still no sign of serenity. I went back to reading.
Bushido required warriors to have nerves of steel, the book said. They must show nothing of their feelings on their face. Children were trained from an early age by being taken to places like graveyards or execution grounds, where they must not show their fear no matter how terrified they felt. If they failed, they were beaten, and in the worst cases, expelled from training.
Warriors were also supposed to show benevolence, which was regarded as a feminine counterbalance to the masculine traits of rightness and stern justice. Benevolence, the book said, included love, affection for others, sympathy, and nobility of feeling. I made a face at the idea of women being loving and sympathetic, while men had to be just and right. But it certainly made sense that all of that toughness should be watered down with a bit of kindness and compassion. The book went on to talk about warriors having to be polite, which seemed an odd thing to worry about when the main aim of a warrior was to chop the head off his enemy. But maybe kindness meant something different in feudal Japanese culture. I read on to learn that Japanese warriors were supposed to be polite, not because of how it looked, but because politeness meant you were in harmony with yourself and your environment. Warriors would actually chide one another for being short-tempered, because it showed that you were out of harmony. Finally, the book said that if a Bushi broke any part of the code, he was dishonored. If he was badly dishonored, he had to commit seppuku, which was ritual suicide. I read the description of seppuku with fascinated horror. The dishonored warrior entered the temple and bowed to the witnesses. Then he walked slowly to a raised platform in front of the altar. He sat with a kaishaku, who was a servant or another warrior, crouching on his left side. An official would come forward with a stand upon which rested the short seppuku sword. The warrior would reverently raise it to his forehead with both hands and bow again to the officials. He would then take down the top of his clothes, tucking his sleeves neatly behind his knees,
then stab himself deeply below the waist on his left side. He would slowly pull the blade across to the right side and upwards. By law, in order to restore honour, he must show no facial expression while